But most histories understate revolt, overemphasize statesmanship, and thus encourage impotency among citizens. When we look closely at resistance movements, or even at isolated forms of rebellion, we discover that class consciousness, or any other awareness of injustice, has multiple levels. It has many ways of expression, many ways of revealing itself: open, subtle, direct, distorted. In a system of intimidation and control, people do not show how much they know, how deeply they feel, until their practical sense informs them they can do so without being destroyed. History, which keeps alive the memory of people's resistance, suggests new definitions of power. By traditional definitions, whoever possesses military strength, wealth, command of official ideology, cultural control, has power. Measured by these standards, popular rebellion never looks strong enough to survive. However, the unexpected victories, even temporary ones, of insurgents show the vulnerability of the supposedly powerful. In a highly developed society, the establishment cannot survive without the obedience and loyalty of millions of people who are given small rewards to keep the system going. The soldiers and police, teachers and ministers, administrators and social workers, technicians and production workers, doctors, lawyers, nurses, transport and communications workers, garbage men and firemen. These people, the employed, the somewhat privileged, are drawn into alliance with the elite. They become the guards of the system, buffers between the upper and lower classes. If they stop obeying, the system falls. That will happen, I think, only when all of us who are slightly privileged and slightly uneasy begin to see that we are like the guards in the prison uprising at Attica, expendable. That the establishment, whatever rewards it gives us, will also, if necessary to maintain its control, kill us. Certain new facts may in our time emerge so clearly as to lead to general withdrawal of loyalty from the system. The new conditions of technology, economics, and war in the atomic age make it less and less possible for the guards of the system, the intellectuals, the homeowners, the taxpayers, the skilled workers, the professionals, the servants of government, to remain immune from the violence, physical and psychic, inflicted on the black, the poor, the criminal, the enemy overseas. The internationalization of the economy, the movement of refugees and illegal immigrants across borders, both make it more difficult for the people of the industrial countries to be oblivious to hunger and disease in the poor countries of the world. All of us have become hostages in the new conditions of doomsday technology, runaway economics, global poisoning, uncontainable war. The atomic weapons, the invisible radiations, the economic anarchy do not distinguish prisoners from guards, and those in charge will not be scrupulous in making distinctions. There is the unforgettable response of the U.S. High Command to the news that American prisoners of war might be near Nagasaki. Targets previously assigned for sent aboard remain unchanged. There is evidence of growing dissatisfaction among the guards. We have known for some time that the poor and ignored were the non-voters, alienated from a political system they felt didn't care about them and about which they could do little. Now, alienation has spread upward into families above the poverty line. These are white workers, neither rich nor poor, but angry over economic insecurity, unhappy with their work, worried about their neighborhoods, hostile to government, combining elements of racism with elements of class consciousness, contempt for the lower classes along with distrust for the elite, and thus open to solutions from any direction, right or left. In the 20s, there was a similar estrangement in the middle classes, which could have gone in various directions. The Ku Klux Klan had millions of members at that time. But in the 30s, the work of an organized left wing mobilized much of this feeling into trade unions, farmers' unions, socialist movements. We may, in the coming years, be in a race for the mobilization of middle-class discontent. The fact of that discontent is clear. The surveys since the early 70s show 70% to 80% of Americans distrustful of government, business, the military. This means the distrust goes beyond blacks, the poor, the radicals. It has spread among skilled workers, white-collar workers, professionals. For the first time in the nation's history, perhaps, both the lower classes and the middle classes, the prisoners and the guards, were disillusioned with the system. There are other signs. The high rate of alcoholism, the high rate of divorce. From one of three marriages ending in divorce, the figure has climbed to one of two. Of drug use and abuse, of nervous breakdowns and mental illness. Millions of people have been looking desperately for solutions to their sense of impotency, their loneliness, their frustration, their estrangement from other people, from the world, from their work, from themselves. They have been adopting new religions, joining self-help groups of all kinds. It is as if a whole nation were going through a critical point in its middle age, a life crisis of self-doubt, self-examination. All this at a time when the middle class is increasingly insecure economically. The system, in its irrationality, has been driven by profit to build steel skyscrapers for insurance companies while the cities decay, to spend billions for weapons of destruction and virtually nothing for children's playgrounds, to give huge incomes to men who make dangerous or useless things, and very little to artists, musicians, writers, actors. Capitalism has always been a failure for the lower classes. It is now beginning to fail for the middle classes. The threat of unemployment, always inside the homes of the poor, has spread to white-collar workers and professionals. A college education is no longer a guarantee against joblessness, and a system that cannot offer a future to the young coming out of school is in deep trouble. If it happens only to the children of the poor, the problem is manageable. There are the jails. If it happens to the children of the middle class, things may get out of hand. The poor are accustomed to being squeezed and always short of money. But in recent years, the middle classes, too, have begun to feel the press of high prices, high taxes. In the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, there was a dramatic, frightening increase in the number of crimes. It was not hard to understand when one walked through any big city. There were the contrasts of wealth and poverty, the culture of possession, the frantic advertising. There was a fierce economic competition in which the legal violence of the state and the legal robbery by the corporations were accompanied by the illegal crimes of the poor. Most crimes by far involved theft. A disproportionate number of prisoners in American jails were poor and non-white with little education. Half were unemployed in the month prior to their arrest. The most common and most publicized crimes have been the violent crimes of the young, the poor, a virtual terrorization in the big cities, in which the desperate or drug-addicted attack and rob the middle class or even their fellow poor. A society so stratified by wealth and education lends itself naturally to envy and class anger.